Well, turn with me, please, to 1 Peter chapter 1, and I'm going to read verses 13 to 16 of that chapter. 1 Peter 1, verse 13, where Peter continues, "Therefore, prepare your minds for action. Be self-controlled. Set your hope fully on the grace to be given you when Jesus Christ is revealed. As obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance. But just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do. For it is written, 'Be holy because I am holy.'" So the theme then of these verses is holiness. And I want to suggest that we can identify in them four distinct aspects of holiness. So let's just work through each at a time. First of all then, notice with me the context of holiness. The context of holiness. Now over these past few years, I've taught on many Bible passages. I've taught on many Bible themes. And God willing, I shall have the opportunity to teach on many more Bible passages and many more Bible themes. But if there's one truth which I hope and pray is understood and remembered by you, the congregation, even if everything else is misunderstood and forgotten, that one truth is this: that God's grace is the primary thing. God's grace is the primary thing. In other words, the essence of Christianity isn't what we do for God. It's what God has done for us. The message of Christianity isn't this is the standard you must achieve. It's this is the salvation God has achieved. The order of Christianity isn't our righteous living earning God's favor. It's God's unearned favor inspiring our righteous living. Because yes, of course, righteous living does have its place. Ethics and obedience and holiness certainly aren't unimportant. But the crucial thing is that they don't come first. And they don't contribute anything at all to our salvation. And they don't capture the heart of what it means to be a Christian. Because fundamentally what it means to be a Christian is this: we have been saved, we have been welcomed, we have been accepted, we have been embraced by the sheer unconditional grace of God. And the transformed life that follows is simply the instinctive response of hearts pulsating with love and gratitude. So the context, I'm saying, of all our living for God, the context of all our holiness, the context of all our obedience is God's grace, that God has saved us. And Peter, I think, brings that out here in two ways. He brings that out, first of all, with that word therefore, with which he begins verse 13. And by using the word therefore, he is, of course, referring us back to what he has just been saying. What has he just been saying? Well, remember, if you were here last week, he's just been talking about the sufferings and glories of Christ. And the way in which the prophets back in the Old Testament searched into the sufferings and glories of Christ. And the way in which the angels up there in heaven search into the sufferings and glories of Christ. Peter's implication being that we too, therefore, who are more privileged than both of those groups, we too should be really searching into the sufferings and glories of Christ. And here now at the beginning of verse 13, he's saying, therefore, as those who are searching into the sufferings and glories of Christ, as those whose eyes are fixed on the crucified and exalted Jesus, as those who cherish the old story of the gospel, as such people, as saved people, as gospel people, let's now attend to the business of holiness. That's the point he's making by using that word therefore and linking the last paragraph with this one in the way in which he does. But then the second way in which he brings this out is by that next phrase in verse 13, which literally in the Greek reads, "Gird up the loins of your mind." Gird up the loins of your mind. Now, at one level, Peter is saying there in that phrase that holiness is a serious business. In the ancient world, men didn't wear trousers as they do today. In the ancient world, men wore long robes, and that was fine until you wanted to participate in some kind of strenuous activity, at which point those long robes were calculated to rather get in the way and be somewhat cumbersome. And so what you would do is you would pick up the bottom of that robe and you would tuck it into your belt. And that was called girding up your loins. And so if you saw someone with their loins girded, you knew that they weren't just popping down the road to Starbucks for a coffee. You knew that they were going to be doing something strenuous. They were going to be doing something which perhaps involved them running, or perhaps involved them climbing, or involved some kind of physical activity. And Peter then is saying here, at one level, at the most basic level, he's saying that holiness, metaphorically speaking, requires girded loins, because holiness is a strenuous and a serious business. But I don't think that's all that Peter is saying in this phrase, because he's actually here, I think, alluding to the Old Testament. He's alluding to Exodus chapter 12, the most famous, the classic instance, if you like, of girded loins. Because there in Exodus chapter 12, in verse 11 of that chapter, Moses instructs the Israelites to gird up their loins in preparation, in readiness for a journey. On the face of things, that seems ridiculous. The Israelites, of course, are under Pharaoh's tyranny. They're in bondage in Egypt. They're living lives of abject slavery. How on earth are they going to go anywhere? How on earth are they going to embark upon a great journey without Pharaoh coming down upon them like a ton of bricks? Well, the answer is that in that same passage, Moses doesn't just instruct them to gird up their loins. He also informs them that God has come to their deliverance. Having already sent those 9 warning plagues, God is now going to do something so devastating that in a single stroke it will shatter Pharaoh's power. And Moses is saying, therefore, you can gird up your loins for a journey, ready for a journey, because God has come to your deliverance. And I think that that connotation is meant to be detected here in 1 Peter 1:13. And Peter is saying here, look, you can gird up your loins for holiness, for a life of Christian holiness. Why? Because God has come to your deliverance. Without that, it would be ridiculous. Without that, it would be impossible to live a life of holiness, just as it would be impossible for the Israelites to march out of Egypt. But you can do it. It's possible, it's feasible, it's realistic, because God has come to your deliverance. And so I hope you see what I'm saying then, that Peter, in two ways, both in this word therefore and in this phrase, gird up your loins, Peter is stressing here that holiness doesn't come first in the Christian life. Holiness is in the context of God having previously saved us, of God having already come down and delivered us from sin. Holiness is always, always in the context of God's prior, gracious, undeserved salvation. And we need to be clear on it, because as I say, then it's a central biblical theme. If you get this order wrong, then you lose Christianity altogether. It's vital that we get this order in place, God's grace, prior to our Christian holiness. In other words, if you're not a Christian this evening, then the great need for you tonight isn't to be holy. It's useless for me to urge you tonight, look, go and clean up your life. Go and be a better person. Go and live more like Jesus. It's useless for me to encourage you to do that tonight, because that's not the issue for you. as I say, it'd be like saying to one of those Israelites, look, just walk out of Egypt, just escape, just go and get your freedom. It's ridiculous. God has to deliver you first. God has to save you first. And the great issue for you tonight, then, as I say, isn't holiness. The great issue for you is salvation. It's coming to God and crying out, save me, Lord. Liberate me from the bonds of sin which currently grip hold of me. And only then, once God has saved you through the blood of Jesus Christ, does holiness become a meaningful concept for you. Peter is establishing the order here, which we must have clear in our minds. The context of holiness is God's prior, gracious, unconditional, no strings attached salvation. But secondly, notice here the starting point of holiness. The starting point of holiness. Holiness, I said a moment ago, is a serious business. That's the main point, as we said, that Peter is getting at with that phrase, gird up your loins. Holiness is a serious business. It can't be taken lightly. It isn't a stroll in the park. And we all know that, don't we? We know it from Mark chapter 9, where Jesus tells us to engage in spiritual amputation, to deal with the causes of sin in our lives. We know it from Romans 8:13, where Paul commands us to put to death the misdeeds of the body. We know it from Hebrews 12, verse 1, where the writer likens the Christian to a Greek athlete stripping himself naked for a race. Cast off every weight and the sin which so easily entangles. We know about the blood, sweat, and tears involved in holiness. We know where Peter is coming from when he uses that phrase, gird up your loins. What perhaps isn't quite so clear, however, is why he particularly focuses on the mind. Because we haven't mentioned that yet, have we? But that's actually what he says, isn't he? He doesn't just say gird up your loins. He says gird up the loins of your mind. Why does he particularly focus upon the mind? Ted Donnelly, the Northern Irish preacher and author, he tells a story of a friend of his in the ministry who once went to visit a young man who was a professing Christian, indeed a lay preacher in his particular denomination, but who had recently made a girl pregnant. And during this visit, this young man showed absolutely no signs whatsoever of any contrition over his recent behaviour. In fact, on the contrary, he was very blithe about it all, and he actually made this remark. Mr. Boyce, he said, that was the name of the minister, Mr. Boyce, God is only interested in me from here on up. And that's a mentality which has bedeviled the Christian church for 2,000 years. That idea that God is only interested in our minds. But it's a mentality, isn't it, which the New Testament simply will not tolerate. I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God, Romans 12, 1. Offer the parts of your body to God as instruments of righteousness, Romans 6, 13. And most strikingly of all, Paul speaking to those Corinthian believers who had been sleeping with prostitutes. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? 1 Corinthians 6, verse 15. The New Testament never ever promotes the external behavior doesn't matter approach to holiness. And we mustn't think that that's what Peter is doing here when he focuses attention upon the mind. Indeed, he goes on to say, doesn't he, in verse 15, be just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do, in all of your conduct. So Peter definitely isn't promoting here an external behavior doesn't matter approach to holiness. So we must ask the question then, what is he doing? Why then does he focus particularly on the mind? Well, as my heading suggests, it's because he's setting forth, I think, the starting point of holiness. He's not, in this one little phrase, giving an exhaustive coverage of what holiness is, but he's setting forth the starting point of holiness. And he's saying then that the strenuous activity, the hard graft, the serious business of holiness begins in the mind. There's a mental effort that needs to be exerted before anything else. And if we ask the question, well, what is this mental effort that needs to be exerted? I think he gives the answer in the second half of the verse where he says, set your hope fully on the grace to be given you when Jesus Christ is revealed. And Peter is saying then that as Christians, we need to get our future glory, the fact that we are heirs of untold riches to come. We need to get that firmly lodged inside our heads. We need to get it firmly drilled inside our minds. And he's saying that that will involve a good deal of effort. It will involve serious mental effort doing that, because instinctively, naturally, left to ourselves, we won't think habitually upon the grace that is going to be revealed when Jesus Christ returns. Naturally and instinctively, we will simply think about the concerns of each day. We will simply get bogged down in each day's affairs. If we do think about the future at all, it will be our pension arrangements for the future, or our funeral arrangements for the future, or something like that. And Peter is saying that has to change. We need to get our future glory into our minds. We need to train ourselves and discipline ourselves and meditate ourselves and pray ourselves into a state of mind whereby we instinctively and habitually think in terms of this future glory for which we are heading. And it's only then, Peter is saying, it's only then that we'll be ready for the more practical, nitty-gritty aspects of daily holiness. Really, he's saying exactly the same thing, isn't he, as what Paul was saying in that other passage we read earlier on in Colossians chapter 3. You remember how in that passage, Peter is practical and Peter is direct. He says in verse 5 of Colossians 3, put to death whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires and greed. He's direct. He goes on later on in verse 12, the other side of the coin, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness and patience. He's really getting to grips with the nitty-gritty here of what we need to do. But notice that's not where he starts. He starts with those first four verses of the chapter. Since then you have been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. For you died and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Paul's saying exactly the same thing. That before you get down to the nitty-gritty of putting to death lust and impurity and greed and putting on compassion and kindness and all the rest of it, before all of that, there's a mental effort to be exerted. Set your hearts on the things above. Set your minds on the things above, on Christ and the wonderful riches of his grace in the gospel. And that's then what Peter is saying here. That's the mental effort that we need to exercise. We need to get to grips with all the privileges and all the entitlements of the gospel. And only then will we be ready to live in a holy manner. But there's one other thing before we move on to our third point. Because we've missed out a little phrase, haven't we, there in the middle of verse 13. In between the exhortation to gird up the loins of your minds and then the business of setting your hope fully on the grace to be given you, there's that little phrase, be self-controlled, as the NIV has it, but that's a rather vague translation. It's literally be sober. It's the literal word, be sober. And Peter is probably including in that exhortation literal sobriety, because he'll go on to say in chapter 4 and verse 3 of this same epistle, you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. So certainly in their past, these people to whom he's writing had a problem with drunkenness. And so this exhortation probably does include literal sobriety, but I think it goes beyond that. I think he's telling these believers to keep their minds free from any form of, as one commentator puts it, mental intoxication. Not just alcohol, but any form of mental intoxication. In other words, anything that will prevent them from setting their hopes on the grace of God to be revealed when Jesus Christ comes. Anything that will befuddle and numb their minds and keep them from setting their hearts on things above. Abstain from any such intoxicating influences, Peter is saying. This came home to me just a little while ago. I was preaching away at a Friday night Bible rally, and I was preaching actually that evening on the future glory that is lined up for us as believers, and it was one of those occasions where in preaching, I myself felt quite moved by the truths which God had laid upon my heart to preach. But after the service was over, I went back to the house of the people with whom I was staying. And there at the house, we watched a program on TV. And there was nothing particularly wrong with the program we watched. It wasn't an inherently bad program. It was fairly harmless in many ways. But, you know, by the end of that program, by the end of watching TV for an hour or whatever it was, that impact which those truths had made on me had gone. They'd evaporated. They disappeared. Because I'd been intoxicated by another influence. My mind had been numbed. I'd been moved by the wonders of the gospel. And then something else had come in and had numbed me and befuddled my mind and blunted my mind. And I'm not for one moment saying that Christians shouldn't watch TV. We all have our own decisions to make on those kinds of things. What is clear is this injunction here, this instruction here, that we must keep ourselves from anything that mentally intoxicates us and befuddles our minds from being focused upon the glory that is coming our way at the end of history. Anything which numbs our minds and prevents us from focusing on Christ seated in the heavenly realms at this moment. Anything, therefore, which will get in the way of us leading those lives of holiness. We need to keep away from any such mental intoxication. It's a challenge, isn't it, to us all. If we're going to gird up the loins of our minds, we need to be focused on Christ and the privileges of the gospel. And to focus on Christ and the privileges of the gospel, we need to abstain from anything that confuses and distorts and takes over our mental faculties. The context of holiness, the starting point of holiness. Thirdly, the difficulty of holiness. The difficulty of holiness. Hannah always says that whenever we go down to Thirsk and we go to the church down there, and I'm talking to my old friends there, that I kind of revert to the rather silly sense of humour of my teenage years, because I'm with these people with whom I spent much of those teenage years. And this isn't something that I do deliberately. It isn't something that I kind of practice on the journey down to Thirsk, kind of going through lots of silly jokes. It isn't something that I go out of my way to bring on, but it's simply a matter then of conforming to a Thirsk sense of humour, because that's my past. That's the world in which I used to live, and it would be very hard for me not in that environment to conform to that sense of humour. I would have to really stop myself and say, hang on a minute, you're 30 now, you should have stopped thinking in that silly kind of way now. You're mature now, you should hold back. It would require quite an effort to do that. The natural thing, the instinctive thing, is just to conform to that sense of humour when I'm there. And in verse 14, Peter is saying it's a bit like that with sin for the Christian. We Christians, when we sin, it's simply a matter of us conforming to those evil desires which are part of our past. That's what Peter's saying here. As Christians, we don't need to go out of our way to sin. We don't need to practice sinning because it's something that's tricky for us to achieve. Because once we lived in a world of sin, once our whole life was a life dominated by sin, and therefore it's very natural for us still and very instinctive for us still to conform to those desires which were so much part of our past. And Peter is saying, therefore, in verse 14, that holiness is difficult because it involves us not conforming to those evil desires which are part of our past. Just as for me, I would have to yank myself back from conforming to that old sense of humour. Peter is saying for us as Christians, holiness is difficult because it involves us yanking ourselves back from conforming to those old evil desires which are so much part of our past life. I love this quotation from Sinclair Ferguson in one of his books. He writes, "The Christian believer goes through lifelong withdrawal symptoms in the development of holiness." The Christian believer goes through lifelong withdrawal symptoms in the development of holiness. Just as a reformed alcoholic goes through those lifelong withdrawal symptoms because alcohol was the world, the realm, the domain in which he once lived. So the Christian goes through lifelong withdrawal symptoms because sin was the realm, the domain, the world in which we once lived. If you expect that when you're converted overnight, you'll just go from that to this, from that old realm to this new realm, without even noticing the transition, then you're living in cloud cuckoo land. That's not reality. The reality is there will be, for the Christian, withdrawal symptoms. And holiness, therefore, will be a battle against those. Just as a sober life for that reformed alcoholic is a battle against those desires, so holiness for the Christian will be inevitably a battle against those sin desires. And verse 14, therefore, is in many ways a solemn verse. Holiness will be difficult. It's about not conforming to the desires which are so much part of our past. But isn't it also an encouraging verse? Because don't you sometimes feel ever so isolated in your struggle for holiness? Don't you sometimes feel that you must be the only Christian that's finding it quite this hard? That for all other Christians it must be a bit easier than it is for you? That nobody else, when you look at them and they seem to be sailing along so easily, nobody else can be experiencing that inner turmoil that you're experiencing, trying to resist temptation, trying to live that holy life. And yet here's Peter, the great New Testament apostle, saying, of course you're going to experience that. Every believer experiences it. It's natural. It's part of the development of holiness in every Christian. These are natural withdrawal symptoms you're fighting against. That other great apostle Paul experienced exactly the same thing, didn't he? Romans 7. Remember his amazing language there. The way in which he says in verse 22 and 23 of that chapter, "In my inner being I delight in God's law." That's all of us, isn't it? In our inner being, of course we want to obey. "But I see another law at work in the members of my body." I see something else going on in my body, "waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin at work within my members. What a wretched man I am." Paul experienced those lifelong withdrawal symptoms. And I'm saying then that there's encouragement here for us. Don't feel isolated in your battle. This is the norm. This is Christian experience in its New Testament form. Holiness will be difficult, because we have baggage that we've brought with us into the Christian life. We have a past that we've brought with us into the Christian life. We used to be under the dominion of sin. We're not under that dominion anymore. But still, there are the withdrawal symptoms. And still we have to actively and strenuously stop ourselves conforming to desires which instinctively we still conform to. The context of holiness, the starting point of holiness, the difficulty of holiness. Fourthly, and finally, the beauty of holiness. Because Peter concludes, just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do, for it is written, be holy, because I am holy. Holiness, I guess, isn't a cool word, is it? Certainly isn't cool in the world generally. It's probably utterly incomprehensible in the world generally. But even within the Christian church, holiness isn't a cool term. If you're organizing a conference, then you don't label it as a conference on holiness. The Keswick conference this year, its slogan, Christ-centered renewal. I'm not criticizing that, but I'm saying that's the kind of title for a conference which attracts people. Or a conference entitled Living in the Spirit, that will attract people. Or a conference entitled Reaching the Nations, that will attract people. A conference that's on holiness, well, that's not quite so exciting, is it? Holiness is this stuffy kind of concept, this stale kind of concept. It's associated with Victorianism. It's not an exciting, modern kind of thing. But in the Bible, holiness is a very exciting kind of thing. Because in the Bible, holiness is nothing less than godlikeness. In the Bible, holiness is nothing less than frail creatures actually becoming like, actually bearing the very character of the infinite, eternal God who created the universe. You can't get much more exciting than that. You see, part of the problem is that we've come to think of holiness as simply a matter of keeping rules. And of course, holiness does, in a sense, involve keeping rules. God has given us those 10 rules, the 10 commandments. But the point is that those aren't 10 abstract rules which we keep for the sake of keeping them. Those 10 rules are, as the old Puritans would put it, a transcript of God's character. In those 10 rules, God shows us what he is like, so that when we keep those rules, we're not just keeping rules. We are actually conforming to the likeness of God himself. Remember how the devil came to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. What was his promise? Eat the fruit, you will be like God. What an exciting, thrilling prospect. You will be like God. But of course, that promise was a wretched, wretched lie. They ate the fruit. Were they like God? They had never been less like God. That great anticlimax in the Genesis narrative, they realized that they were naked. That was all the fruit had done for them. It hadn't for one moment made them like God. But you see, the wonderful story of the rest of the Bible from Genesis 3 onwards is that God comes back to human beings with the same promise that the devil had come with. He comes with the promise, you will be like God. Not this time through eating some forbidden fruit, but this time through coming in faith to his son Jesus Christ and being washed in his blood and then living the life of Christian obedience, keeping the 10 commandments. That way God promises you will become like me. And this isn't a phony promise like the devil's. This isn't a lie. This is true. This is real. God is saying to all of us tonight that if you come and believe in my son, are washed in his blood, and then go out in the Spirit's power, living the life of the 10 commandments, you will be like God. Holiness is exciting. Holiness is radical. Holiness is breathtaking. Holiness is you and me in all our ordinariness, normal, Newcastle people tonight. It's you and me becoming like the living Creator God who reigns on heaven's throne. What an ambition, what an aspiration. May we be encouraged tonight then to pursue the beauty of holiness. and become more like God. Amen.